recording. I was specifically told that we were to write synopsises.
Now, who told you that?
I believe Mr. Gardner told me that.
And who is the producer of the show?
I understand that, but I think he owns the keys to the network, as I understood it.
You know what?
I thought he could shut the whole thing down.
I don't even think he has the password anymore.
That's not the password.
I think the keys to the, you know, he's got the keys to the Rolls Royce and sitting in his driveway running, but he doesn't know how to get in.
I keep seeing him like the old man in RoboCop. You're fired!
Pretty much. I think that is pretty accurate.
And now it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Stop it!
What's in the box?
Disenfranchised by the modern comics industry, producer Paul Spataro, Dr. Bill Robinson, and Scott H. Gardner now
ply the time stream in a never-ending quest to rediscover and reconnect with that unique brand of fun and excitement that can only truly be found in good old-fashioned, randomly selected comic book back issues. Journey with them now. Back to the bins.
I got nowhere else to go!
I got nothing else.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here with Mr. Scott H. Gardner.
Hi.
And Mr. David, no middle initial, Pasquarella.
How are you?
I don't know. I hear such enthusiasm from the two of you. And such. I'm just ready for an intelligent discourse about these
with
comics.
This group? Discourse? This is more like an intercourse, not in a good way.
You know what? I got to go. What's happening, boys?
Not too much. How are you guys?
Trying to survive.
Looking forward to a little bit of Florida weather in the next week.
Yeah.
And seeing my boys. Have you made any preliminary plans for how you're going to do things? Is Logan coming? Have you talked to Matt Hunsworth?
Hey, you know, it's funny you should say that, because I don't know if the ding was audible in the recording or not, but I just got an answer back from Matt, and I texted him earlier, said, we still good for Saturday? And he texted back, he says, yep, when and where should we meet? So, yeah, I got to work that out. But, yeah, we're gonna carpool over together. We're, for the listeners who are wondering what we're talking about, we're all meeting up in Brandon, Florida at, what's the name of the, Urban Legend Comics. Whoa, great,
whoa,
great
whoa,
shop.
Whoa, back up. We're meeting at Cracker Barrel. Then we're going to Urban Legends.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds even better to me.
First, I have to have a lumberjack breakfast.
Now, Ken's going to meet us, right?
Well, Ken, Bill, and I will be traveling together. Probably, my guess is Ben will probably be coming along, just because Ben usually does come along.
Right.
And that's why I mentioned Logan, to see if he was coming along.
I will talk to Logan. I don't know. He typically works on Saturdays, so I don't know if he'd be free or not.
The trip to Urban Legend is one of our, you know, one of the things I look forward to with the trip down there. You know, Ken has mentioned Emerald City, because that's become just a kind of a tradition. He picks us up at the airport, and then we stop at Emerald City. But it's not as if we get great buys there. Mm-mm. I mean, I don't want to dog the place, but it's just become traditional that we stop there on the way. And then there's another place called Sound Something or Other, where they have old, you know, old vinyl albums, and they do have a very small comic selection. But you know, we may do that as well. And okay. Saturday is our Cracker Barrel and Comics Day.
Looking forward to it. Hopefully we get some good buys over there. But yeah, I love that shop. The guy that runs it's super, super nice guy, super friendly, and always, you know, has good deals and that sort of thing. Yeah. Promises to be a good time.
I have since the last time we went shopping here, or even, you know, it's been a long time since you went shopping here, but the last time Dave and I went shopping, which is not quite as long ago, I've started going to a place called Kyle's Comics, which, first of all, Kyle is a really good guy, so that starts it off well. And second, he's got, you know, pretty good buys. It's funny because everything is mislabeled. he's got like the bins of books that are marked $5, but there's a sign on the wall that says all $5 books are $2. So it's like, you know, you already know you're getting them for $2. It's not even like you got to bring it over to the register and say, well, what can you do for me with these?
That's funny.
And then he's got the $10 books, but if you buy five of them, you get five free. So they end up being, the $10 books end up being $5 books as long as you get 10 of them. The only bad part is he seems to have, and he's not going to argue with us as far as our opinions on it, but from a money-making point of view, I don't think he has a choice. He's dealt with, you know, selling some slabbed books. And that's, you know, it's just the nature of the business. That's where you can get better money.
Right.
So, but other than that, it's a great shop, and he's a really good guy, and, you know, you feel comfortable when you go in there. When Dave is around, we're going to have to see that, and maybe if you come up, you know, as we've been starting to make some preliminary plans, if you come up to New York in the not too distant future, we'll get there as well.
I sure would like to. I really would like to.
To come up to New York.
Well, no, I mean, you don't
these
even.
These are the comic stores you were going to.
Dave's waving his hand and doing the Jedi mind trick. It's not even that. It's just, I mean, it's the same old problem. It always comes down to time and money. You know, can I get the time off and do I have the money? But
money, you go into debt like everyone else. You take another mortgage against your house.
Right. But yeah, I certainly would like to. I mean, and it doesn't even have to be, you know, there doesn't have to be an event. I just like to come up and just hang out, you know, come up and do like a long weekend type of thing and, you know, go hit some shops type of thing.
Yeah, I think the event is probably not going to be what we do, only because, I mean, we could do a minor event. But, you know, New York Comic Con, I don't think you will. I'll put it this way. I mean, I think you know, you'd go and you'd say, okay, it's something I haven't done before, so it could be like a check it off your list kind of thing. But I don't think you'd be impressed by the event itself. Not that there aren't good buys, not that there aren't good celebrities, but it's just so crowded and so,
right,
you know, just that just, you know, turns me off to the whole thing, to be honest with you. And like every major comic convention now, it's, you know, it's a big money grab. You know, you need to spend, you know, $75 to $80 so you can come in here and spend money.
Right. I think I'd have a much better time just coming up, hanging out, and we go hit some local shops, you know, that you would recommend and think that would be good ones. I think I'd enjoy that so much more than any convention, honestly. Well, so.
They do a show here now, and Dave and I are planning to hit one in March, maybe. And it's the third Sunday of every month. They do a small show. It's just comics and some collectibles, but it's one room, you know, one good size room. It's $5 to get in, and you know, you go in and you go nuts through the $1 and $2 bins.
There you go.
So, you know, maybe if we're going to plan a weekend for you to come up, we'll plan it on one of those weekends.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think I'm done with the, you know, the Hollywood cons or whatever the hell you want to call them. You know, they keep plugging them as Comic Cons, but they're not really Comic Cons. They're like Celebrity Con or whatever the hell. And I don't know. I've been burned one too many. I think I'm done with them.
You're better off going to a comic show at the church.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I feel like if it's convenient, and I remember in San Diego when San Diego Comic-Con is there, like I said, for you for New York, it might be a check that off the list. You know, okay, I've done that. Right. But other than that, I don't really care.
You know, the thing is, it's like New York Comic-Con. If you realized you were going to be here that weekend, it's, you still have to have bought the tickets. What is it, 4 months ahead of time?
Right.
Yeah, I used to have some connections that I could get tickets from at the last minute, but I no longer have that.
And I mean, honestly, for me, I mean, having only been to New York City twice and for, you know, very quick and limited times both times, if I'm going to go into the city, there's so many more things I'd rather do with my time, honestly, than go, you know, be stuck in, you know, 50 million smelly nerds, you know, and I'd rather do other things, honestly. So
fair enough.
So living here, we can't possibly imagine why you'd want to go into the city for any reason whatsoever, but if that's your thing.
Well, pre-pandemic, Dave and I went to New York Comic Con one day, and we both walked out of there saying, all right, that's it, no more. Yeah. We haven't been back since. I can't say I haven't been at all tempted, but we have not been back since.
No, they burned us. The 7-block line to get in the door, and we only cut the line because Dario was on it already.
That's crazy. Nope. No, thank you.
So, on that happy note, today we are doing what we like to call a traditional episode. Three funny books, a Marvel, a DC, and an indie. And I have the Marvel.
So I have the DC.
I have the indie.
Does it have Green Lantern in it?
No.
Does it have Green Hornet in it?
I don't think it has anybody green in it. It's kind of a ripoff, if you ask me. Anyway, I chose, and I kind of did go random on this, and I pulled out Astonishing Tales number 11, which, even though I went randomly, it's kind of a significant issue because it has the origin of Kazar and Zabu. And the cover of it has, it is a clearly a Gil Kane drawn cover. And it has Kazar facing the reader, and he's kicking Magor the Man-Ape, who's coming at you in a very Gil Kane pose, while behind him, Zabu is holding at bay some of the other Man-Apes. And it is one of the ones I've complained about where the actual cover art is a box in the, you know, low underneath the title. And then it's got like kind of a white border around that. I still don't see the need for that border. I would rather it just cover the whole cover. But this is what they were doing at the time. And then one of the things I noticed offhand before I forget is that just as drawn by Gil Kane, it looks like Kazar has about 40 ribs. So the story opens.
He's in the gifted program.
Yeah. It's got a... The story opens with what you call Barbara, who eventually became Mockingbird, coming through the jungle with some dude named Paul.
Is that her? I didn't catch that.
Yes, it is. And the title of the issue is called A Day of Tigers, and it is written by Roy Thomas, drawn by Gil Kane. The inker is Frank Giacoya, and it's lettered by Sam Rosen. So as the two of them are making their way through the jungle, a giant anaconda grabs a hold of Barbara and then pulls her up into the tree. At that point, Kazar and Zabu just luckily appear, and Kazar tackles the incredibly long anaconda, and they go into the water together. And then, you know, just when they think maybe they're dead, Kazar's head pops up out of the water, and he cuts up the snake, figuring that they'll make a meal out of it, but everybody else is just too much of a delicate flower to eat that, so they don't. And Kazar starts to think back, not to the bins, but he goes back and he starts thinking about years ago when his father came to this area, and he fought basically the elements, because there was an avalanche. And he fell, and he came into the actual savage land. And there you see there's a T-Rex that he's near. And he discovers some sort of an element. And he makes notes and figures out how to, you know, to maintain it. And he leaves. At this point, coming back immediately, Kazar's mother is dead. And he is at the funeral with his brother, what's it, Percival, and who is eventually... Parnival. Life is a Parnival. And he, the father gives them each a half an amulet, which he says, half is worth nothing, but together they will give you your fortune. And Kevin Plunder, who will eventually be Kazar, doesn't really care. He's more worried about his mother being gone. And Parnival is kind of a doofus. So the father gets approached by some thugs who want to get a hold of this. And he basically fights them off and sends them off. But they say, you know, don't worry, we'll be back, blah, 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 blah. And the father takes them, or actually sends Parnival with an uncle and takes Kevin to the Savage Land, where the father is promptly killed by the ape men, by the man apes. As they go, as they're ready to kill Kevin, Zabu comes out of nowhere and rescues him, and Kevin rides him off like a horse. Little by little, eventually they show how they grew up together and that, you know, something was going on, because for some reason Zabu never seemed to get older, even though Kevin never noticed it. Luckily, Kevin found the loincloth manufacturer over there and had clothes to wear. So, all of that said, adult Kazar is, you know, becoming the lord of the jungle, and he is hated by Magor. And Magor is kind of, you know, creepy looking. He's got one eye. He's the ruler of all these man apes.
Magor's a douche.
He is kind of a douche. So then they attack Kazar and Zabu. Kazar tries to make peace with them, but they're not having it. They're like, screw that. They throw spears at him, and eventually Zabu takes a spear to the shoulder, which is just, you know, maybe just the slightest bit better than an arrow to the knee, but not much. And that's it. You know, Kazar had enough. He pushes a boulder down, which kills all of the man apes except for Magor. And the two of them battle it out. And there's some very good Gil Kane fight choreography there. And then when Kazar has Magor down, he shows him mercy to let him live, or doesn't show him mercy because he lets him live with his failure, and the two of them walk off. Or with the two of them, meaning Kazar and Zabu. And then he stops thinking back to the past, and you have Barbara and Paul sleeping there. Now, I understand, just from what little I remember, that Paul turns out to be a douche. And like I said, Barbara ends up being a mockingbird eventually. So, my thing about this is it is extremely predictable. Let's put it that way. There's nothing about it that's really unexpected. It is very Tarzan of the Apes-ish. But it's cool. I enjoyed it. And as I almost always do at this point in my life, I really enjoy the Gil Kane storytelling and artwork. You know, there's something about his art. And, I mean, we've talked about in the past how he doesn't have the traditional style that, you know, the clean style that I look for. But there's something about it that I love, that there's this film noir feeling to everything that he draws. And there's just this grittiness to it. So that I always enjoy it. And again, his fight scenes are, you know, they're all very well choreographed, even though we see similar poses frequently in a lot of his books. So ultimately, this was just a fun read for me. Based on mostly based on the art, but even the story was kind of fun too. What'd you guys think?
I never even heard of this character before you sent the book over.
Really?
Really?
Yeah, I have no experience, knew nothing about it. And having read it, I will say it was enjoyable. Typically, I'm not like a Tarzan fan, to be blunt, but this was good. It was fun. And I'm glad you brought it to my attention. You know, knowing nothing about this, All I'm going to say is he probably should have killed this guy, because I'm certain he's going to come back to cause problems. I mean, you killed all the other folks. At this point, what's one more body in the count?
Not only does he come back, but if my memory is accurate, he goes through the vapors that give them, you know, give Kazar more strength and give Zabu his, long life. And he gets advanced and he becomes a much more powerful person with vengeance on his mind.
And he becomes Dr. Doom. Is that his origin?
But Kazar, you know, for somebody who's not familiar with him at all, Kazar is sprinkled throughout the Marvel Universe. He's had several different series, some of which have, you know, been fairly long run, you know, 40 issues or so. And he is frequently a guest star in a lot of the books. He's been in the X-Men several times where they've gone to the Savage Land. Spider-Man has gone to the Savage Land a few times.
That's how I knew him from, because Gil Kane illustrated those issues too.
Yeah, that was my first experience with him, was in Marvel Team Up number 18.
Is this area they're in called, is that the Savage Land?
Yeah.
So it's sort of like that whole theory about, you know, a hole in the North Pole or something, or the South Pole.
I think it's more, instead of being like inner Earth type of thing, like Warlord, and correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, on any of this, but I think the Savage Land is supposed to play more on that thing of who was it that flew over the South Pole? Admiral Byrd, I think, said and reported back that he had seen like a green zone with like prehistoric animals and stuff. And they kind of wrote him off as a kook about that whole thing. But I mean, that's actually a real historical thing that happened. I think this is playing off that, because it's basically in the middle of Antarctica. There's just, for some strange reason, in the middle of all the ice, there's like this oasis of like a lost world that, you know, it's like perfectly tropical, and you know, there's all kinds of dinosaurs and, you know, everything like that. Right, Paul? Isn't that?
Well, that's the theory. I mean, the way you say it now, it almost sounds like it really exists, that there is dinosaurs that we could go see now. But yeah, you are describing it, you know, the theoretical Savage Land properly.
Right. Admiral Byrd, that was a task force that was sent down there. Right, a Navy task force.
There was one that was sent in on foot, but then there was one of those famous explorers, and I thought it was Byrd, but I could be wrong. But there's one of those famous explorers that did a flyover, like a solo flyover, and ended up reporting this back, I think by radio, if I remember right. But he ended up being kind of written off, like maybe he was like
insane,
like having some sort of like low oxygen delusions or something, you know, something like he was just crazy, you know. Basically they wrote it all off. But yeah, there's a whole thing.
There was I did a little quickie research. It was called Operation High Jump, officially titled by the U.S. Navy, led by Admiral Richard Byrd.
Yeah.
1956. You were there, Paul.
I don't know. I really have much familiarity with Kazar either. Despite I was looking at my collection, I actually have a fair number of his books. Due to the, you know, a number of the, you know, because he's had several titles over the years, and so I have a number of his that have works by certain artists like Rich Buckler, Val Mayerick, and then Ron Frenz's first gig was on Kazar the Savage in the 80s. And I have all of the Ron Frenz issues of that. So I have a lot of his stuff, but I've read precious little of it. So I was looking at this, which I'd never read before, and noticing, okay, this is the origin issue. I'm presuming this is the first time, because it says revealed at last, that this is the first time his origin's being told. And I'm noticing that the date is April 1972. And I'm thinking, this guy's been around since Marvel Comics number 1 in 1939, and they're just now giving him an origin?
Marvel Comics number 1 is not supposed to be the same person.
Exactly, yeah. So I looked it up and was kind of surprised to discover that this is at least the second Khazar. So I thought that was kind of weird. I didn't know that there was actually more than one Khazar. So I don't know what the story is.
I believe he was introduced in X-Men number 10 as his first appearance, which I have. And he also appeared in some early Spider-Man issues and some early Daredevil issues. So Khazar's first series went three issues, and it was reprinting those stories.
Right.
Then he had a second. Then he basically his second starring vehicle was in Astonishing Tales. Astonishing Tales eventually branched out. He got his own series off of that, which went, I'm tempted to say, 18 issues, and I have that full run. Then there was Khazar the Savage in the early 80s, which went 29 issues, something like that. And I have that whole run. The next series was in the 90s, and I do not have that. Interestingly, in one of the storylines in that series, he fights Thanos. And he defeats Thanos. And that was eventually where Jim Starlin, you know, it almost came up with the Thanos Doombot version, where they were like these imperfect duplicates of Thanos that were sent out, and that those are the ones who were defeated, you know, by lesser beings. So, you know, it's just, you know, some interesting tidbits. But I found I've always found the character to be interesting. You know, early on, he was definitely just a Tarzan ripoff. When they got to Khazar the Savage, it was actually just the opposite of what the title might indicate. Because in that one, he spoke much more fluent English. You know, he wasn't the me Tarzan Eugene type character. He was clearly educated and spoke, you know, in a much more sophisticated way and, you know, knew how to, you know, knew of the Eastern ways, I guess you'd call it.
Right.
But, you know, I've always found them to be an interesting character, and I've mostly found it best when he does interact with other characters that we know. Even in the Khazar the Savage one, he is with Shanna the She-Devil, who's another Marvel character who ends up being his wife by the time that series is done.
Right.
So again, I've always enjoyed the character. I don't remember specifically if they had any type of origin tale before this. I don't think they did. I think they, you know, made mention of some things that we got in this, but this is the first time there was an actual like origin issue.
That issue of Daredevil that we covered with him, does that predate this?
I don't remember which one we covered with him.
I don't remember either. I just remember that it had Parnival in it as the bad guy that he eventually becomes, the plunderer or whatever the hell his name was.
I'm pretty confident that predates this by several years. I think that's a relatively early issue of Daredevil, you know, maybe in the teens or 20s.
I just gotta say, as you know, just as a heads up to any parents or potentially parents out there, if you name your kid Parnival, it's your own damn fault when he grows up and turns to a life of crime. That's all I got to say. What the hell kind of name is Parnival?
That reminds me of the Jerry Seinfeld skit where he talks about if you name your son Jeeves, pretty much he's got to be a butler.
Right.
I heard he opens a cruise line. Parnival.
Parnival Cruise. I totally did not catch that this was Bobby Chase. That's actually kind of cool.
This is where she was introduced. It's interesting when you go into some of these issues, because, you know, she's there and what's her name? Carol Danvers, Ms. Marvel, you know, is in the early issues of Captain Marvel.
Right.
In kind of a similar role where, you know, she's there often to be the damsel in distress. And then, you know, for them to turn into the characters they eventually turned into is just kind of fun to see.
So Khazar's dad was one of the Blackhawks.
This reminded me very, very much, and the Gil Kane art actually plays into that, but it reminds me very much of the first issue of Marvel Premiere that had Iron Fist in it.
Yeah.
Where they go, you know, the father goes to Kunlun and he gets killed, and, you know, it's similar in a lot of ways.
I gotta say, I enjoyed the origin. You know, I enjoyed the whole issue. It was really good and everything. But the part that was a bit of a bridge too far for me was you know, you've got these guys, these gangsters, these toughs, whatever they are, foreign spies, whatever, that, you know, want the element and all that stuff. And the butler gets the drop on them and everything. And they stand there with the butler aiming a shotgun at them and threaten Plunder's kids, threatens both of the boys in his home. And I'm thinking, he's the father is, I mean, this is terrible parenting. You know, is he stupid?
He started by naming him Parnival.
Well, yeah, there you go. But I'm thinking, you know, I'm a father of two sons. When, you know, if this had happened in my home, somebody's standing there threatening my kids, and I've got a shotgun there, they ain't walking out the front door to threaten my kids further and to carry out their threats. So instead of doing anything about it and taking this threat out, he splits the boys up and then goes on the run. I'm like, what? That part of it didn't make any sense to me. What was this plan? Why did he do this? I don't know. That part of it didn't really make a lot of sense to me. Other than, you know, if he removed the threat, then of course then there's no story. But
well, he also sends the other kid off with the butler. It's not even a relative,
right?
Oh, I heard about this Batman guy. Yeah, you go off with the butler. Let's see how that turns out.
He was a good butler.
Yeah, no wonder Parnival turned to a life of crime. He was abandoned by his father with a stupid go live with the butler. Yeah.
Hold on. Well, how old is Parnival? How old do you think he is? 5, 6, 7?
I'm thinking a little older. I'm thinking like 8.
Yeah.
8. Yeah. Oh, okay.
He's like 8 or 9, yeah.
He's practically an adult.
Right.
Yeah.
A guy comes into the house, there are two guys threatening your dad. The butler has to come out with a shotgun, and he's taking an attitude like, oh, you're such a wuss up there hiding. What did you want an 8-year-old to do?
Right.
Yeah. Kevin took the bull by the horns.
Well, Kevin's the star of the book. Kevin's also telling the story.
So, you know what? Instead of Parnival, he should just name them Fredo. That would do the trick.
Okay, so Parnival, go get your shine box.
So what's the whole thing with the mists? Is this supposed to be like the Terrigen mist with the Inhumans or something? Like he gained some sort of powers and it kept Sabu from aging?
I think, something? Yeah. I think they give Kazar like greater strength and they give Sabu his longevity.
Okay.
It's kind of like a little blue pill. For Sabu, it's a little blue pill.
Well, I'm glad that there's finally an explanation for this because, again, I don't know a lot about the character, but that is one of the things that's driven me crazy over the years is that despite having never read this before, somehow or other, I knew that he and Sabu grew up together. I don't remember how I knew that, but I did know that. And I'm thinking, how does that work? So I actually asked Siri. And according to Siri, the average lifetime of a tiger is 17 years. So it's about like a house cat's lifetime. So I'm thinking, how is this cat, for one, how is he still alive? Like, how old was he when he met Kazar? But then, even if he's still alive, he would be like a senior cat, you know? But
he'd be wandering around, bumping into things.
Well, just sleeping all day, you know, that sort of thing. So I like that there is, it's a shitty explanation, but I like that there is at least some explanation of his longevity. At least, you know, at least there's something. They're throwing you some bone rather than just saying, oh, yeah, this cat just, you know, doesn't age, whatever. So
it's the mists that were in the Marvel office when they were writing this stuff.
Yeah, there's a mist, all right.
Yeah. Just what was it coming from, and what did it do to your brain?
I liked it though. I do like these, you know, Jungle Man type stories, and this was actually pretty decent. Really, my only issue with it was the art. I like Gil Kane. I consider myself a Gil Kane fan. This ain't his best stuff, but I'm wondering, is that on the inker? Because it's awfully scratchy. It's very Kubert-like in its scratchiness, and I don't like that scratchiness.
Well, the scratchiness, though... See, I'm accepting of scratchiness, and you've given me the other example where I am accepting of it. Kubert and Gil Kane, for some reason, it doesn't bother me the way it would other people. But that's just me.
There's one picture of Kazar when he's a kid on page 7 where he's standing next to the butler with the shotgun, and he just looks completely evil in that picture.
Which page?
Page 7.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't it look like he's... Kill him, Willis. Go ahead, kill them both right now.
Yeah, it looks like he could be Damien. Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly the vibe.
Butler with a shotgun sounds like a damn good movie, by the way. I'd watch that.
Better than Hobo with a Shotgun?
There you go.
I got a kick out of it. Never having read any of it or knowing it existed, I got a real Tarzan Commandy vibe, putting them together.
Right.
Yeah, especially since we are now in getting into the Commandy storylines.
Now that would be a crossover.
Yeah, Kazar and Commandy.
After DC, Tarzan went to live over at Marvel for a short time, but do either of you guys know that was he part of their... He was kept separate from their universe the same way he was kept separate from DC, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's a shame. It would have been interesting to see these two characters meet and, like, fight. Something like that.
Oh my God, Sabu ate cheetah.
Well, right,
we got anything more on this?
That's all I got.
All right, so I like the cover. The cover's got good action on it. I don't blame the artist for the fact that they had a company-wide misguided thought of boxing off the cover. As far as I'm concerned, it's misguided. So I'm not going to hold that against them, because the entire series, the entire company run would have had that. So if you're sitting in the candy store looking for it, you're going to see that on every issue. I think it's got good action, and I'd want to read it. So I'm going to say it's solid B on the cover. The interior...
Where in the jungle does Magor buy that particular shade of lipstick, though?
That's a good question. I don't know. Maybe there's some five and dime out there. So the interior art, honestly, it's typical Gil Kane. There's so many of the Gil Kane flourishes that I see in this that I enjoy so much. Could it have been better inks? Yeah, I guess it could have. It's, this isn't an A book, but I think it's a solid B. And the story, while predictable, I think it is entertaining, and I think it does the trick. It was fun to read. So I'm going B's all around, and I'm going to give this book overall a B.
Yeah, I'm not going to beat a dead horse. I'm in the exact same spot with you. I gave the cover a B. The interior art, B. The story I thought was really good, and I bumped that up to a B plus. So overall grade from me is a B.
Yeah, I really liked the cover. I didn't really notice until you pointed it out that it is one of those covers from this time period that you and I have commented on before. I think what works for me really well in this one is that even though there is the box, Kane is going outside the box because Kazar is kicking Magor, and Magor is actually flying out of the box, which gives it a slight like three-dimensional feel. And I think that's really cool. So he's making use of the limitation of just that little window box, but in a really interesting way. So I think that actually works very well. Despite some wonky anatomy, I think it's actually a pretty cool cover. So I'm actually going to go a B plus on this one. I really liked the cover. I thought it was really cool. The interior art, unfortunately, I mean, I love me some Gil Kane, but this ain't his best stuff. There's nothing wrong with the layouts or anything like that. I really think it entirely comes down to the inks. There's just something wonky going on with the inks. It's not horrible or anything. It's just I know I've definitely seen better stuff by Kane. But that said, the stuff that I like, I really like. My favorite sequence of the book was page 17, where Kazar's just basically had enough, and he wedges himself between the ledge and a giant boulder, and just I love the strain and everything that's showing on his face as he uses his body as a wedge to break the boulder free and to crush all of Magar's men. That's pretty awesome. I really like that page. And there's some really nice. I mean, it's very action packed and very dynamic, staged very well. So I mean, it's great as far as all of that goes. It's just some of the actual finished art's a little rough. So art wise on this one, I think I'll go a B- on the interior art. And then the story, I really enjoyed the story. I thought the story was pretty solid, honestly. My only quibble, honestly, with the story is that Kazar's dad seems kind of stupid. And then Kazar makes the same stupid mistake as well by leaving Magor alive at the end, only to come back to haunt him. And you said yourself, Paul, that Magor does come back. So, you know, I can kind of forgive it with the dad because he's a civilized guy, you know, it's civilized society, but this is different. This is the jungle. This is rules of the jungle, and he's basically king of the jungle. I don't think there's any compunction at all for him to just off this guy if he thinks he's going to come back to plague him later, or let Zabu do it.
And he already killed a bunch of people.
Yeah. So,
what's one more?
For him to leave Magor alive, for one, it seems really stupid. It also seems a bit cruel. You know, he's already maimed this guy. Now he's killed all of his tribe, and he just kind of leaves him alive at the end. For, again, like I say, to come back to haunt him later. But also, that's just, I don't know, it's just do him in at this point, you know? Do the poor guy a favor and just end it, you know? But that aside, yeah, I really enjoyed it. So actually, I think I'm going to go a B+ on the story. I enjoyed the story. I thought it was pretty cool. And it makes me actually want to read more about the character. It makes me want to dig out those issues that I already have. I don't have many of this particular one, the Astonishing, but I have quite a few of some of the, you know, some of his later stuff. So yeah, I want to dig that stuff out and actually read it now. So yeah, good book.
All right, so Marvel is out. Let's bring in the DC.
All righty. I have brought to the table Superman number 405. Cover dated March 1985. On sale date December 13th, 1984. A cost of 75 cents. This is written by Craig Boldman. Pencils by Alex Savick, inks by Carl Kessel, colored by D'Angelo, lettered by Ben Oda, and edited by Julius Schwartz. Our issue is entitled The Mystery of the Super Batman, or as I like to call it, The Horny Superman.
Do I make you horny, baby? Do I? Do I make you Randy? Yeah.
In broad daylight, two thieves, having robbed a museum, are making their escape. They shove aside a panhandler and jump in their getaway car. Suddenly, something smashes through the hood, disabling the vehicle. It's a batarang. There stands Batman. Criminals in Gotham City feared the Batman. But this isn't Gotham City. It's Metropolis, home of the amazing Superman. A turn of the page gives us newswoman Lana Lang reporting on the museum robbery attempt with a graphic depicting a hero garbed with Batman's cape, cowl, and utility belt, but wearing Superman's traditional emblem and costume. As the news plays, Clark Kent is putting through a call to Bruce Wayne to explain the strange events in Metropolis. In a flashback, we see earlier that day, Clark Kent and Lana Lang visiting the Metropolis Museum. There, Lana's archaeologist father unveiled a new acquisition, the Golden Pipes of Pan, also known as the Shrinks of Arcadia. Professor Lang explains the artifact was created by an ancient cult who worshipped Pan, the Greek forest god. Lana, unable to control her curiosity, plays the ancient flute, which causes a severe pain to shoot through Clark's head. Clark wobbles and realizes that neither the Langs seem to hear the piercing noise, which nearly rendered him unconscious. Arriving home, Clark continues to suffer from a debilitating headache. He stumbles into the bathroom, looks in the mirror, and is shocked to learn that he has grown horns that would make Satan himself turn green with envy. Superman flies to the Fortress of Solitude to determine how to counter the flute's magical properties. His supercomputer reveals that Pan, god of the forest, had a goat-like appearance, cloven hooves, and a small head with horns. And this Pan cult had been looking for their leader, what they claimed to be a superior being, one who would be worthy of serving as a liaison between them and Pan. Superman surmises that the Pan cult must have had some knowledge of sorcery, because the Shrinks was created to magically brand the potential leader for their cult with a telltale sign, the Horns of Pan. Somehow, Superman concludes that another magical blast of the flute will cure his condition. He uses his telescopic vision and discovers that the Metropolis Museum is being robbed and the flute is being stolen. Wanting to keep his condition a secret, Superman grabs the Batman apparel from his Fortress's Batman exhibit and dons the cape and cowl. He uses his super aim to hurl a batarang from his Arctic hideaway all the way across the planet to Metropolis, causing it to crash through the hood of the thieves' getaway car. Super Batman speeds to Metropolis, captures the crooks, and delivers them to jail. He then borrows the flute. In his apartment, Clark blows and blows on the flute, but to no effect. A little bit of a delayed reaction there. Then he notices chips on the flute, and when the gold starts flaking off, he realizes the flute's a fake. After a brief visit from Lana, who warns him that their boss, Morgan Edge, wants Clark at work the next day, he goes out on patrol. Super Batman foils another robbery. A scowling Super Batman, who tries to scare two muggers into surrendering, is jeered by the crooks, who think he's a clown in a costume playing games. Realizing that Batman's approach isn't working, he uses his heat vision to crack open a fire hydrant, and with a blast of super breath, freezes the water and the crooks in their tracks. Causing further destruction to public property, Super Batman uses his super strength and rips up the pavement with the frozen thieves and flies them off to prison. It may have been cheaper all around to let the couple get robbed. In dealing with his horny issue, Clark decides to end a televised report on a skydiving club by diving out of an airplane wearing a helmet to conceal his horns, which he has worn the helmet throughout the story. How he is able to get the helmet on his head is another mystery. Morgan Edge is shocked that the scaredy cat Clark Kent has jumped from a plane. Super Batman uses his super memory to recall all the details of the museum heist. Suddenly, he realizes that the museum thieves were double-crossed by their boss. The panhandler that bumped into them during their escape was a pickpocket who switched flutes with them. Super Batman visits the thieves, who give up the name of their boss once they learn they've been double-crossed. He then confronts the small-time boss, Wesley Wood. In a last-ditch effort to escape, Wood blows the magical flute, which brings our hero to his knees with searing pain ripping through his head. Momentarily powerless, Superman must use Batman's tools, and with the bat rope from his utility belt, is able to capture the fleeing crook. In subduing Wood, he learns that the backer of this whole affair is Roderick Forrest, a pan-slash-forest god aficionado and the kingpin of Gotham City's big crime wheel, which is trying to expand operations into Metropolis. Trying once again to be menacing, Superman confronts Forrest, but without the cowl, and simply as a horned Superman, delivering an over-the-top performance to scare the criminal. Forrest, knowing the significance of the horns of Pan, cowers before Superman. The issue ends with a no longer horny Clark Kent explaining in a call to Bruce Wayne the events of the day and asking how he ever manages to scare anyone in that getup of his. The next day, Clark returns the pipes of Pan to Lana for her father. Morgan Edge explains that he realizes Clark would rather risk his neck than ask for a raise, so he's giving him one, as long as he doesn't risk his neck anymore, because a good newsman is hard to find. My God, I can't believe this story, to be blunt with you. I picked this, having not read this since I bought it off the rack in 1984. Oh, my God. What did you guys think?
This is Superman with what is it? Gold kryptonite that makes weird things happen?
Red
kryptonite. Yeah. Excuse me.
Red. That's what I thought this was.
This is a red kryptonite story. Right.
Yeah.
Instead we got the god Pan involved in it.
I don't know why. That was my first thought in this story, is I don't know why Superman didn't just tell people, "Oh, I've been exposed to red kryptonite." That's all he had to do. Why the bat cowl? And a bigger question for me was, okay, so the cowl, all right, whatever. Why the gloves and the belt too?
Right.
Because they're convenient to the story.
I get, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And why did he feel he needed to become Batman?
Yeah.
Unsuccessfully.
You know, something I had meant to look up, and I totally forgot. I'm going to do it right now. That panel on page, it's early in the story, in the flashback, page 6, where he's zipping past the Batman room in the fortress, I think that's lifted from that Fortress of Solitude book that we did. But I need to look for sure of that. But I really think it might be.
Could be.
Could very well be.
Yeah, this seems, it's a weird thing, because this seems almost like, when I read this, I felt like I was reading a Bridge story, because first it started with the artwork. The Alex Saviuk art feels like it's a bridge between Kurt Swan and what would happen in, like, the 90s. So, you know, it's like somewhere in the middle. It's a little bit more developed, but it still has some of the feel of that stuff. And then story wise, it's like a, you know, it's a bridge between the Silver Age and the Bronze Age, where they have to get silly with the red kryptonite type story, and then they give it that little bit more depth of, oh, he's wondering what makes Batman scary to them that he doesn't have, and you know, things like that. But it really feels like feels very much like a filler issue. Like, it doesn't have any significance to it. And you know, you read it, you enjoy it, especially if you like 10, and then you move on.
Yep.
It's almost like they wrote a Red Kryptonite story and were told, all right, we got to take a break from these Red Kryptonite stories. They're just ridiculous. So they came up with, let's make it a magic flute instead of kryptonite, and we're good.
Yeah, that's much more adult.
You know what stuck in my head all these years from reading this? The scene where he gets in the elevator and he's wearing his hat. Because he hadn't worn a hat for quite a while in the comic books.
And right. Woman says,
oh, yeah, you know, you can't be wearing, a man doesn't wear his hat in the elevator. So he blows out the bulb with his heat vision and takes off his hat. I don't know why that always stuck in my mind.
Where did this lady come from? 1930?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
She's got the little pinball, or whatever they call those little hats that the women used to wear.
Pillbox, that's it.
Yeah. And he's wearing, you know, a fedora from the 1950s. So, you know, and then she's, you know, she's all up in arms. You wouldn't wear a hat in the elevator.
Don't you know you're not supposed to wear a hat in the elevator? Don't you know you're not supposed to talk to strangers?
Well, see, don't you know I don't give two shits, lady?
This is, what'd you say? This was 1984?
Yeah.
See, this, when right after Byrne rebooted Superman, this is the sort of thing that, for me, was Exhibit A, when they would piss and moan about Byrne having rebooted Superman, or DC having rebooted Superman. This is the sort of thing I would point to. Is that here you are in 1984 still telling stupid ass Silver Age stories? You know, I mean, by this point, you could occasionally maybe get away with a story like this, but this was the standard type of thing that was going on as late as 1984 with this character. It's like he's just like stuck. You know what I mean? He's stuck in this weird silliness, and it's
because also at the same time there are stories coming out that deal with pretty heavy issues like nuclear war and how, you know, right. If we had a nuclear exchange, only Superman would survive, like he'd be the only person left, and all the horror of that,
right?
And then you have funny Superman,
right? Yeah, exactly. The to me, the strong point of this is the art. I really enjoy this. I you know, over time I've really become quite the fan of Alex Saviak on certain characters, and I like his Superman quite a bit. And of course, this is inked by Carl Kessel pretty early in Kessel's career. This is within his first year as a professional, and I think they're a pretty good pairing. I think it actually looks really good. Some of the shots in here are fantastic. I love Superman using the key to get into the fortress, and then that shot on, I think it was page six of Super Batman snapping up the two villains. That's actually really cool. I mean, that's a nice amalgamation of the two characters' costumes, you know, in one. That actually looks pretty cool. It's just the story's dopey.
This right. story feels like it would have fit in a World's Finest issue back in, you know, the early 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I couldn't help but wonder if these are supposed to be the same pipes of Pan from, there's an early story of Fury of Firestorm that I think is right around this same general time period, I believe. Maybe a year or two before this. There's no mention of that or anything, but it's just odd that, you know, the pipes of Pan are coming up again.
I wonder if that was something in popular culture back then.
Maybe. You know,
that particular
not that I remember.
There. He had Zamfir in his pan flute. He sold more albums than Elvis, the Beatles, and Boxcar Willie put together. Oh, and Slim Whitman, too. Page 7, panel 4, you've got Clark Kent. He's going to go out to do some investigating as Super Batman. He says, I don't usually go on patrol at night. Huh? Since when?
Yeah.
Every goddamn Superboy story I ever read, he went out on night patrol just before he went to bed and, you know, went back to the Kents and did his homework and went to bed. So when did he stop doing night patrols?
Not Union that I did. Metropolis has union rules.
I guess. No crime at night. I'm tired.
Well, wait. Let's stay on that page. Look at the wad of cash this guy was carrying around. He was asking to get robbed.
Right. The bad guys' names are Wood and Forest.
Yes.
Seriously? Okay.
Well, listen, also looking at the amount of property damage he does. He busts up the fire hydrant. He rips a major chunk out of the sidewalk. Now, do you think when he arrives at the police station with these guys and leaves this slab of concrete there, they're going to be happy with him?
Well, this is right during the Super Dickery years where he would do stuff like this. Page 15, second panel, where he's gotten rid of Batman's cowl. Now he's fully embraced having Satan horns on his head. So to go and capture Forrest, he comes smashing up out of the floor, holding his cape in front of his face and doing this whole intimidation thing. But look at what he actually says. It says, blah, and I'm like, blah, what?
No, you're doing it wrong.
Like, is this supposed to be like, yeah, that's not how it reads, though. It reads, it's like he has a weird stutter or something. It's really, I don't know, it's odd.
You know, I was inspired by this when my kids were little, and when they would misbehave, I would go, blah, and I thought that it would calm down and behave. But yeah, now I've come to realize that was the problem with the entire childhood of my children.
I thought you were going to say you put horns on your head.
Well, before I would go, blah, yeah, of course.
Oh, look, Dad's horny again.
Blah. Yeah, no, that's... Yeah, if it said "wahaha," you'd say, you know, he's doing the evil laugh.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, he's freaking Superman. He doesn't have to scare these guys. It's not like, you know, it's not like he's facing off against Brainiac or you know, somebody who he wants to get a mental edge over. These are regular people. He could just flick them with his index finger and knock them out.
Well, honestly, having read this and the second feature in the book...
since you've read it, do you want to talk about it briefly?
No, I don't. It's horrible.
Is that a kid that you'd like to see thrown into the sun or what?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Quickly, for the folks at home, it's this little bastard who comes to Metropolis that his folks are friends with Perry, and... he doesn't believe there's a Superman. In a world where Superman's on the TV, he's in the newspaper, he thinks he's like Santa Claus and doesn't believe till he sees him. He gives Doubting Thomas a run for his money.
The only part of that story that I liked is where the kid said something about, you know, prove it by jumping out the window. I think he should have thrown the kid out the window. Yes. And then when he was within inches of splattering on the sidewalk, he saves him and goes, "Now, you little bastard, now do you believe I'm in Superman? Do you believe I'm Superman? We good? All right. I don't want to hear any more of this shit."
It's funny, the only part of the story that I liked was when Dave said we weren't covering it.
The best part of this entire issue, in my opinion, was the Crisis on Infinite Earths ad and the ad for the DC Heroes role-playing game, and that was pretty much it. Yeah, this was a stinker. It was a pretty stinker, but it was a stinker.
I say, I'm not quite as high on the art as you are. I mean, it's okay, but I don't think it's anything outstanding. And I'm kind of low on the artwork on the cover. I don't like this positioning of Superman at all. Now, I know you want to keep it a little bit of a mystery as to his head and the horns and all of that, but... He looks way too stiff to me.
It looks like they shot him and he's falling over.
Yeah, he doesn't look like he's flying down to them. I don't know. It's just, I don't like the angle. And I don't like the way Superman's body looks. It's not badly drawn. I just don't like the choices that they made.
Right.
See, now I remember, as far as the cover goes, I do remember as a kid finding this very intriguing. And that's one of the things that sold me on the cover. The Superman with the Batman shadow. I couldn't understand where they were going with this. Of course, I was only a mere, 12 years old or so.
You gotta rub it in every time, huh?
I might have been younger, Paul, but so I find the cover slightly better. I'm going to give my ratings. I would rate the cover a B minus, whereas the interior art I did like, and would give that a B plus. The story itself, I think the story's terrible, and I'm going to give the story a D. For an overall grade on this, as a B, it's a C. Being generous to C, because I have some fond memories as a kid of reading it, but the story is terrible. It's just unnecessary. The you could have done this with Red Kryptonite, and we've had more than enough Red Kryptonite stories.
Right.
The whole, why does he need to try and act like Batman? Because he has the cowl on? Maybe it's some kind of superhero regulation. I don't know. But the story's terrible.
That's the thing to me that still, I'm still walking away from this issue with no answer to the Batman thing. Why the hell, other than the fact that he just happens to wander past the Batman room of his fortress and see the cowl. I mean, is that meant to be the explanation? Because that's pretty shit if that's the case. But that's how it appears. Is that he just goes, well, this will work. Well, I mean, so would a fucking hat. So I don't get it. You know, it makes no sense.
The whole thing is, well, so would a hat. You know, I see this in life all the time where people say, well, what am I going to say about this? What am I going to say about that? And I always come back to, you don't know anybody an explanation for things that you do in life, you know, for the most part. So somebody comes over to him and says, Superman, what's up with the horns? His response could be, mind your effing business. I understand why he doesn't want anybody to see Clark Kent with the horns.
Right.
But Superman with the horns, so what? Yeah, I got horns. What are you going to do about it?
All right, well, listen, I understand.
Don't make me gore you.
I understand how he puts a fedora on, because there's room in the hat. How the frig does he get the helmet on his head?
Yeah, I thought about that, too. I just, by that point, my brain had pretty much stopped working with this story. So, yeah, I just kind of rolled with it. But, yeah, it doesn't make, because if you look at the picture where he's holding the helmet in his hands after taking it off, yeah, there's no way that helmet's going to fit with those horns sticking up the way that they are. So, yeah, that doesn't work. It does not work. Because it looks to be a pretty form-fitting helmet in the pictures where he's actually wearing it, where there's not room for the horns. So, yeah, I don't. Unless the horns are flexible, like, you know, is that stuff in your nose? The
cartilage?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'm thinking they're rubber. you gotta have the bad look and certainly no function.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm going to say, again, I was not pleased with the cover. I didn't like the angle at all. I think there's so many ways that could be done where Superman could look more imposing and yet you still don't show why they think he's Batman. I'm going to say, if I, you know, as a kid, if I saw this on the stands, I would not be intrigued by it, frankly. I would probably, I'm going to give this a C minus on the cover. I don't like it. The interior art is definitely better. But I you know, it's, I don't think it's great. I think it's okay. So I'm going to say, I want to say a B minus on the interior art. And the story is just stupid. It's not incomprehensible, but it's stupid. Right. So I'm going to say a D on the story. And overall, I'm going to give the book just a C.
I like the cover, but I'm with you. I'm not crazy about the cover. I really like Eduardo Barreto, and I really like Eduardo Barreto's Superman. This isn't his strongest. I get what he's going for. He's trying to keep the reveal of why Superman has Batman's shadow, you know, the horns, from you as the reader. So I get that, but I think that there was a more creative way to do it, a better angle to do it. I mean, your hero of this title is literally showing you his ass, and that's pretty much what you're seeing. If this was your very first impression of Superman, seeing this on the stands, I don't know that you'd be terribly impressed. So, yeah, for that, it's not the greatest cover. Nothing really wrong with the art. It's just the layout itself. So, yeah, I'm with you on that. I'm going to say a middle-of-the-road C on that. Interior art, yeah, I really like it, but I've come to really, really like Alex Saviak on Superman. It's a little cartoony. It's a little cartoonier. His whole style is much more cartoony than I really like for my superhero comics. But for this era of Superman, it works pretty well. And, of course, Carl Kessel is one of my favorite inkers of all time. So it's a little rough. You can tell it's early in his career. But some of the shots in here are really pretty spectacular. So art-wise, I really dug it. I'm gonna go a B on the art. I really did enjoy it. The story is an absolute D-. It's not an F only because I could follow it from beginning to end. But other than that, it's just stupid. So stupid. And an overall grade for the issue, especially if you lump the backup story in here as well, I'm going to say a C-, and I think that's being extremely generous. That's mostly because I really do dig the art. But other than that, yeah, it's this was not a good issue. Sorry.
All right, so it's time to move on to the indie.
Okay, all right, strap in. This is going to be a doozy. All right, so for my book, I am bringing to the table from Now Comics, Fright Night, number 14. Has a cover date on it of December 1989. Was actually on sale on the stands, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, on September 1st, 1989, for a whopping $1.75. And I'm going to get back to talking about that. The cover is by Neil Vokes and Tammy Daniel, depicting a very Dracula-esque figure beckoning a young buxom woman to him amidst a misty, spooky background complete with full moon, ominous castle, and lurking bat, or maybe it's a gargoyle, I'm not sure. The issue, entitled Resurrection of Dracula, is written and edited by Catherine Llewellyn, co-plotted and penciled by Neil Vokes, and inked by John Stangeland. So a bit of history on why I chose to bring this particular book. So back on August 1st, 1988, almost 3 years to the day since the release of the now cult classic film on which the series is based, Now Comics, which was a scrappy little independent comics company, released the first issue of a new ongoing monthly series called Fright Night. And I was beyond thrilled because I was a huge fan of the film, having seen it first run in the movie theater with my cousin, and was very excited to follow the continuing adventures of Peter Vincent and Charlie Brewster. The film was a modest success and had been gathering its followers on VHS and such, and talk and rumor of an impending sequel, which would be delayed and delayed and delayed again, kept interest in the franchise alive. My hopes were high that the comic would do as the best of the Star Wars and Star Trek licensed comics had done and keep the story going between films, filling in the gaps and maybe even giving us teases and glimpses of things and threats to come. Well, didn't exactly work out that way. The first two issues of the series adapted the R-rated film as if it were meant for the same crowd reading Archie, and took all the teeth out, quite literally, of a fairly violent and gruesome horror flick. The art is passable at best, and the adaptation feels rushed and muddy, and I don't honestly see how anyone who hadn't seen the film first could really make a lot of sense out of it. This would go for the eventual adaptation of the second film as well. And that rushed and muddy feel of the storytelling would become indicative of the feel of the entire series, in my opinion. Issue 3, The First Adventure Beyond the Movie, was a decent enough story, a sort of throwback to the old EC horror anthology titles of the day, of days gone by, with Charlie and Peter battling brain-sucking bats from outer space capable of reanimating the dead. And no, I'm not making that up. It actually was better than it probably sounds. Unfortunately, issues 4 and 5 weren't much of an improvement, as they featured a killer squid man and a spider boy. Issues 6 and 7 finally featured the return of vampires as the threat to Peter and Charlie. Then they find themselves hunted and pursued by the Legion of Endless Night, a society of quote-unquote master vampires, intent on avenging the deaths of two members of their ranks, Jerry Dandridge and his sister, from the two films. It's a pretty good two-parter, all things considered, if you exclude the inclusion of a friendly giant who saves the day. And no, I'm still not making that up. Issues 8 and 9 feature the long-awaited, much-requested, sorely anticipated return of Evil Ed, complete with photo covers on each issue, but they are a mixed bag. Clearly, Now Comics knew that this character was pure gold with the fans, and they weren't going to waste, squander, or kill him off. Unfortunately, in their effort to use him sparingly, they kind of wasted and squandered him. I don't know what the hell issue 10 was all about, so don't ask me. Issue 11 is slightly better, but we're back to aliens again with a light sprinkling of Evil Ed and the introduction of a new recurring support character. Issue 12 sees Charlie and his girlfriend, Natalie. By the way, there was no mention ever made, at least thus far in this series, as to whatever happened to Amy from the first movie or the smoking hot Alex from the second movie. So Natalie and Charlie are off to Greece to recruit Natalie's weird aunt to join them in their monster fighting. Unfortunately, what starts as a fairly strong and interesting issue devolves into them fighting the Minotaur alongside a resurrected Theseus, who's actually an alien, I guess, in catacombs under an ancient palace or something. Which brings us to issue 13 and the straw that broke the camel's back. I was buying Fright Night faithfully back during this time, but as it cost significantly more than all the other titles I was purchasing, as much as an entire dollar more in the case of the Superman titles, and wasn't really giving me what I wanted out of the title, I'd begun to grow disenchanted with it, and it was on my mental chopping block. This was the issue that done me in. It features easily the worst cover of the series, with a photo of a little girl playing with a ball while cartoon animals surround her. It's weird, not particularly appealing, and makes you go, "This is Fright Night?" Peter Vincent is not in it. He's off filming a new movie. And Charlie only appears as the guest host of the Fright Night TV show to introduce the story of a little girl and her weird cartoon animal friends. Now, in fairness, rereading the story again after nearly 35 years, it's actually not a bad little tale. It's actually kind of sad and creepy, but it isn't what I want from Fright Night, either then or now. So I quit the book cold turkey, and it eventually faded away after issue 22 and a handful of 3D one-shots. Which brings us to the issue I'm bringing tonight and why. So over 3.5 decades since I walked away from the book, I have picked up issues I missed back in the day as they've come along cheap. Recently, I actually completed the original 22-issue run. I still lack two of the 3D specials. And thought I'd get around to, you know, actually completing the series, you know, rereading it and finishing the ones that I'd never read. So don't worry. this is not going to be a long synopsis. So issue 14, Charlie, Natalie, and their new friend Derek are concerned about Peter Vincent as he's acting all weird and seems to think he is the Van Helsing character he's been playing in a production of Dracula. They go and check out the institute where this production has been taking place and end up getting hypnotized, I guess, by the handsome, seductive, creepy, Dracula-worshipping, Sean Connery-looking Dr. Newbaum. Charlie and the gang are bused to a remote mountain village where they apparently believe they are characters from Dracula or something, while Newbaum watches on a bank of video monitors because reasons. Anyway, Evil Ed shows up and turns the actor playing Dracula into a real vampire and orders him to go after Van Helsing, who's, of course, actually Peter Vincent. And the issue ends with, quote-unquote, Dracula having bitten Charlie's girlfriend. To be continued. What did you think of this masterpiece? were you able to make heads or tails of it, first of all?
I have to say I found it a little hard to follow. And part of my problem following it was, outside of reading it because we were covering it for the show, and I like Fright Night, like much like you do, but this comic just didn't feel like Fright Night to me. I think without reading it for the show, I would have no desire to read this. So it was kind of a slog to get through. I don't like the artwork in it. I feel it's much too cartoony. This should have definitely have a dark feel to it that the cartoony art doesn't give me. The story just didn't really go with me. Like, I don't know. It didn't feel like Peter Vincent from the movie. It didn't feel like Roddy McDowall. I mean, it looks to me like they didn't have the character image rights, so they had to change them a little. So just, you know, on a whole, I read it, and I felt like, yeah, all right, okay, I got that done. You know, felt like a little bit of a chore, frankly.
I felt the characters were a lot dumber than the ones in the movies, as far as they got roped into this whole thing where I don't think they would have been especially having gone through what they went through in the movie. I don't think they would have been suckered in as easily as they were in this.
Right.
I mean, oh, drink the blood of Dracula. I wouldn't take a glass of water from this guy.
Yeah. You know, everything you're saying is exactly how I feel and how I felt back then and how I feel rereading it now. I read these 14 issues in rapid succession, in 2 days. And while I was able to glean a little bit more, I think, this time around, and there was at least one story arc over two issues that I did kind of dig. Overall, I still walk away with much the same impression I had back in the day, which is it still suffers from very unclear storytelling. I made a snarky comment in my thing here about issue 10. I said, don't ask me what it was all about. Well, don't ask me, because I read it and I didn't understand it. There's a part in that where the narrative shifts, and I literally can't tell, is this a flashback? Is this a dream? Or, like, what's going on? Because you're following one character, and then all of a sudden the panel style shifts to what in comics language usually indicates either a flashback or a dream sequence. But there are no narration boxes and nothing to give you any clue, like, what the hell is going on? So you are literally left lost. And I couldn't glean it from the dialogue. I couldn't glean it from what happens later in the issue or in the conclusion of the story, the next issue. There is, like half an issue in issue 10 where I just don't know what the hell that was all about. I never could figure it out. And that's not an isolated incident. It happens a lot during this. In this particular issue here, I thought it's not quite as vague as number 10 was, but overall, I still thought it was pretty vague. Like, what exactly is going on and why is it going on? So Charlie and the gang are... What happened to them? They've somehow been brainwashed or psyched up to where they literally think they're characters from Dracula, I guess.
Yeah. But then
they're bussed to this this remote mountain village, and then you've got Dr. Newbaum watching them on monitor. Is this all? I thought this was a play.
Did you get a vibe like Westworld?
Yeah, almost. And that's what I was trying to figure out is like, okay, I thought this was like a play, like a stage, like a small stage production at the Institute. But now all of a sudden, if they're off in this village, is this a movie because he's monitoring them? Or is this some sort of massive role play event? It's like, what the hell is it? And they never explain it. I've even read the next issue where it's all wrapped up, and I still didn't understand it. It just doesn't make any goddamn sense. And I don't understand why, with everything that happens, nobody snaps out. Well, actually, the actor, the Dracula, was he ever sucked into this in the first place, and did he snap out of it, or he never was zonked like everybody else? I just give up with the story. It just didn't make any sense.
I got the feeling that he was in on it until he got his throat ripped out.
Well, right. I mean, when Evil Ed comes in, he says, "I'm just an actor, please." So I don't think he doesn't seem to be in on it.
And I don't understand. What's the end game here? What is Dr. Newbaum's thing with this? Because there's this weird sequence where you find out he's actually a Dracula worshiper. So is this to try to resurrect Dracula? I can't make any sense.
Suddenly, Superman 405 is looking like that was a pretty good story, wasn't it?
Yeah, that looks like high art compared to this. And it's sad because as the series has gone along, I've kind of gotten used to the art. I won't say I like it, but I've gotten used to it. It is better than it started out to be, but it's the wrong art style for this genre, for this franchise. Absolutely. It's much too bright, it's much too cartoony, it's much too almost kind of silly.
Picture this story making a little bit more sense. You know, I mean, the story would have to be a little bit more smartly written, but picture that, and picture the artwork by Bill Sienkiewicz.
Yeah.
Now that's a book I want to read.
What this feels like to me is, imagine that there had been a Saturday morning cartoon show based on Fright Night, and this was the comic series based on that cartoon show. That's what this feels like to me.
Yeah.
But the thing that's missing, of course, is that there never was. So this is supposed to be, you know, a continuation of the films, and in this silly, goofy, childish Saturday morning cartoon way, it just don't work. And I'm hoping against hope that it gets better. But then even if it does get better, I mean, this is issue 14. It only ran to 22. So even if it gets better, I'm pretty sure that the series ended on a cliffhanger. So it's only going to disappoint me one way or the other. Either it doesn't get better and it just ends, or it gets better and maybe even really good and it still ends. So yeah, it's at this point, it's just I'm just kind of torturing myself to get through it to see. But yeah, this story here is resolved in the next issue and wasn't really very good. And I think I'm up to like 17 now, and I haven't quite. The jury's still out on that next story, so, whether it's actually any good. At least it does have vampires in it, though.
So do they solve it by Scooby and the gang shows up?
Kind of.
It's got me, in my mind, it's got me thinking about a couple back when we did that issue of Ghostbusters, which we also, or at least I remember my criticism. I don't remember if you guys agreed with me or not. But one of my criticisms was I thought the artwork was a little too cartoony and it could have been a little bit better done. But the story was fun,
yeah.
If I'm remembering it all correctly.
Right, yeah.
And it still kind of captured some of the feel of the movie. This doesn't feel like it does that. This doesn't feel like it captures the essence of what made the Fright Night movie so good. And right. And that was, you know, that was a horror movie, but it also had an element of comedy and fantasy to it. And it blended it all really well. And it was just, you know, just, I'm surprised it wasn't a bigger hit than it was, frankly. But this doesn't have that feel about it at all. And I think your description of it, you know, basically a poorly adapted Saturday morning cartoon, and then this is a poor adaptation of that poor adaptation. And, right. That, you know, like, you know, I know that isn't the sequence that it really followed, but that is what it feels like. I think you hit that on the right on the head.
Well, the bizarre thing is that this isn't the only thing that now did like this, because the other big thing that they scored just prior to this, they had Terminator. So they were actually the first company to have the Terminator franchise. And that ran, I don't know, something like 17 issues, had the exact same problem as this. You're taking an R-rated, ultra-violent property that was very, very popular. And again, Terminator had the same problem. It felt like a Saturday morning cartoon version of that property. I don't remember it being particularly bloody and violent and all that. And I'm thinking, why?
This is that the series 10 years later, Terminator, The Burning Earth?
So that is where Terminator proper ended,
right?
At whatever issue it ended at. Terminator the Burning Earth, my interpretation has always been that was their attempt to address the issue that Terminator had, which was it just didn't feel enough like the Terminator. It wasn't dark, it wasn't moody, it wasn't gritty, it wasn't bloody, it wasn't violent. It didn't feel like Terminator. It felt like Terminator the cartoon.
Right.
And so at least art-wise, because we covered this at one point, and if memory serves, we didn't really think much of it as far as the story, but at least artistically, it does feel much more faithful to Terminator, because at least it's dark, it's gritty, it is violent, and all of that, but I don't know, I'd have to go back and listen to those episodes to remember exactly what we said, but we did cover it. Mm-hmm. You know, a while back. I just don't remember our ratings being particularly high on it, but it's certainly better than the series that you know, that came before it, because I had such high hopes for Terminator because there was a preview of that in an issue of Rust, and I remember the preview being pretty damn good. Like, oh, this is, you know, the art's really rough, but this is going to be good. And then it just wasn't. It just really wasn't. But I do think it was better than this Fright Night one. I'm just so disappointed with this Fright Night. I mean, I'm not sure exactly, honestly, what you could do with Fright Night anyway, but this wasn't it.
Well, the first thing would be to take the Comics Code Authority off the cover.
Yeah, that's what I don't understand is that, you know, again, this is an independent company. This isn't Marvel, this isn't DC, this isn't any of the other. You're a brand new entity coming along, why are you feeling that you have to do this cartoon thing? Why don't do what you want to do? I mean, you've got two huge properties, and they do this weird cartoony take on both. It just makes no sense to me.
I don't know how thought out it is, though. I don't know. You may be giving them more credit for actually, you know, planning this out than they really should be getting.
I guess. But I did a little bit of homework on this. I discovered this kind of by accident, because the thing that really was bugging me, and I remember this being ultimately between just not really enjoying it, in the story and not getting any better. But the thing that really did break me on this was that not only wasn't it good, and it just didn't seem like it ever was going to be, was that it was $1.75. So I looked into this, and these are all the books that I remember buying off the rack the same month that this issue came out, or actually issue 13, the one that broke me. That's where I quit, was issue 13. So all of the Superman titles at this time, and there were three of them, was Action Adventures of Superman and Superman. They were all 75 cents, so a dollar less than this. And then most everything else, you know, your standard books, Spider-Man, Avengers, you know, Batman, all of that, were a dollar, so 75 cents less. And then a bunch of weird ones at different things. The ones that were the same price was Legion of Superheroes, New Titans, and Young All-Stars, which, you know, varying quality, but all better books than this. And then the only thing I bought that was more expensive than this was Aliens and Predator, two separate titles. Aliens was one, and then Predator. These were the first sequels to those movies. They were done by, I believe it was Dark Horse in their early days. They were $2.25, but the difference here is, yeah, they were a lot more expensive. Those were freaking awesome, and they did it properly because they were faithful to those properties. That Aliens, that first Aliens, I think is a 6-issue miniseries, is the best Aliens there's ever been since the second movie. It's the story that Alien 3 should have been. It's great. And then the Predator sequel, that was, it's a lot like what Predator 2 became, but it was excellent as well. I don't remember it quite as well. I haven't read it in a long time, but both fantastic, continuations of those two franchises that felt genuine to those movies that inspired them in a way that neither Fright Night or Terminator ever did. And they were, 50 cents more. So, yeah, it's... They just... Unfortunately, they're just squandering this. I am going to continue to read it, and maybe I'll report back at some point when I have finished the series and the one-shots. Because I don't know if the one-shots tie into the series. I don't know if they... Like, if the series ends at 22 on a cliffhanger, I don't know if the one-shots pick that up. Or if they're something complete, I don't know anything about them, so I'm just going to have to find out on that. But I don't know, just so disappointing. It could have been great, and it just wasn't. But this right here, honestly, this was the worst issue so far, and I was really hoping that, after all these years and diving back in to the next issue after the one where I quit, that I would have found, like, oh, gee, I should have stuck with it because it got really good. Well, no, it didn't. This was actually worse than the issue that was before it, which was the one that made me quit. So, yeah.
See, I thought that, like, Fright Night, the movie, was kind of a cult hit. It, it didn't have the big box office. But I think word of mouth spread and people learned about it. And I don't think I ever spoke to anybody who saw it and didn't like it.
Right.
I think it was pretty popular. It just was not a huge moneymaker. It was more of, like I said, more of a cult hit. And I kind of anticipated that this book would be the same way. I thought it would have the same feel about it. And it is really disappointing to open it up. And I kept hoping, frankly, as I was reading it, maybe it's because this is issue 14 and I didn't read issues 1 through 13, but you're telling me no, that wouldn't help it in the slightest.
No.
So, you know, it is a big disappointment, frankly.
Yeah.
Now, I look at the cover, just by the way, my first thought when I looked at the cover is Ra's al Ghul talking to somebody with derp face.
Yeah, with Batman on top of the building.
Yeah, with Batman looking down at them.
Yeah. It's that's not a bad description.
But, you know, the whole feeling, part of the allure of Fright Night, I think, was the feeling of frustration that Charlie is onto something and nobody believes him.
Right.
And even Peter Vincent has to kind of be brought along as it comes along in the movie. And I think that's one of the things that makes the movie so enjoyable. And I think that's, they needed to find a way to feed on that and to make that the thing, you know, yeah, okay. You know, you did these things, but people they still don't believe you. They're not buying into what you're saying. And you keep having, you know, it should be Kolchak, the Night Stalker, really is what it should be.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's not.
And I know Kolchak. This was no Kolchak.
No.
No, by the time the series starts, it's like Charlie and Peter are like Billy Batson and Mentor, like they're off on monster hunting adventures together. And I'm like, what happened to reluctant, kind of a pussy Peter Vincent that had to be dragged into the house to fight Dandridge? What exactly happened to that? Because that's a better dynamic for them. You know, him as the, you know, on screen he's Peter Vincent, the fearless vampire killer, but in real life he's just an actor who's scared out of his mind. And
it took every bit of courage that he could muster to stand up to Dandridge.
Right. And that's gone by the time that you're getting to issue 3, the first adventure beyond the first movie. That's all gone. Now they're officially like monster hunting buddies that are going on adventures hunting, you know, fighting monsters. And it's like, that's not those characters. That's not their thing.
That's Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. Right. And it doesn't help that, with the exception of Evil Ed, there's no reference made to any of the other characters from either of the other movies, including Charlie's mother. Charlie's mother has yet to be mentioned in any of this. So it's like, what's going on with Charlie? Is he not living at home? Is he off on his own? Is he still in college like he was in the second? Like, what's going on here? And you get nothing whatsoever. There's not yet been any explanation of Natalie, his girlfriend. Like, when did they hook up? And I kept thinking that maybe there was something with her. Maybe she would be revealed to, like, she's working for the Legion of Endless Night, or maybe she's even a vampire. Nothing like that. So you get nothing. You don't know what happened to Amy. You don't know what happened to Alex. Evil Ed is around, but squandered. That's one of
the reasons, though, you buy a series like this is you want to know what happened to the people.
Right.
And they're exactly not touching on anybody.
No, they're not. They're not. They're using Peter and Charlie that don't really feel like Peter and Charlie. And that's it. And you're following them. And they're not even in all the issues, because some of the issues, again, do the horror anthology thing like EC Comics. You know, it's so either Peter or Charlie, or sometimes both, are acting like the Crypt Keeper to give you the intro to a horror story that doesn't really play into the narrative that's going on with the main characters. So it's a very odd, weird read.
They might have been better off if they really wanted to make it an anthology, was have Peter Vincent be the host who gives you an intro, and that's all he does. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and then there's a story.
Yeah, just have it be, you know, the series is called Fright Night because every issue is that week's or that month's TV show, you know, because he hosted a show called Fright Night where he showed his old movies, and have that be, I mean, it would be disappointing, but at least it would make a little bit more sense. Right. You know,
it's like, you know, it'd be like that show Freddy's Nightmares.
Yeah. Yeah. Had
in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, they didn't do that. And I'm not sure why, but, I am going to finish it just because I was committed to it now to finish it. So anyway, at some point I'll report back of what I thought of the whole thing, whether it got any better or whether there was, you know, ever any other issues that, cause there were at least a couple issues that, you know, that I genuinely kind of thought were all right. I mean, they weren't great, but at least I felt like they were trying to do something that was a little more in line with the movies and had something to do with the movies, because again, you know, the whole reason that the Legion of Endless Night is after them is to avenge the deaths of, you know, the two vampires from the films. So there's that connection. You know, you find out that Dandridge and his sister were members of that organization, and the organization's pissed that Vincent killed them. So that part of it was interesting to me. Whether anything further comes of that or not, I don't know. The problem with that is that Peter and Charlie are on the run through that issue. They end up holing up in this like shack in the swamp type of thing where this old couple lives, and they're there with them and trying to both seek shelter, but then also they don't want to drag these poor unsuspecting, you know, this old couple into their problems and potentially get them killed. Okay, all of that's fine, but then you find out that the old couple is harboring a terrible secret, which is their son was some sort of mutant freak who's basically like the friendly giant that lives in the woods. So late in the story, as the vampires come to attack everybody in the cottage and basically are overrunning them, kind of like Night of the Living Dead or something, all of a sudden the friendly giant comes out of the forest and like, he's got like giant hands and he's like smashing them together and like tearing. And I'm like, what the hell is this?
And does he go, ho, ho, ho?
Right. So, yeah, you know, that part of it was just bizarre. Like, where is that coming? You know, where are you pulling that from? But so, yeah, like I say, it's a weird read. It's,
you know,
it's,
you know that misty cloud we discussed earlier? That's where this series came from.
Yeah, I'm thinking so. I don't know if we want to do grades on this. If we are, I'm just I'm going to go super low. The cover on this particular one it's not good. I don't like the coloring. I don't like the staging. I really don't like anything about it. I'm gonna go. I think I'm gonna go a D on the cover. It's pretty bad. And I get the whole thing with the big moon in the sky and everything, but if the moon was that close, then the Earth's in serious trouble. So that doesn't work for me. Interior art is better than it's been up to this point, but that ain't saying much. It just doesn't work for this particular title. I'm going to go a D+ on the art just because it doesn't fit. It doesn't work with this title, and it's not great. It's not horrible, but it's not great either. And then the story is a flat, it's a D-. It's so stupid. It's just stupid. I can't follow it. I don't understand what the hell is supposed to be going on. I don't understand the motivations and the whole so deeply hypnotized that even traumatizing things don't knock me out of the hypnosis. It just seems ridiculous to me. So yeah, overall grade on this one is a D-. And even that I think is being very, very generous. So yeah, I was horribly disappointed by this.
I'm going to echo a lot of what you said, but I'm also going to change a little bit in that I am actually going to give the story an F. And I don't give Fs freely for exactly the reasons that we've talked about in the past, that, you know, we don't want to do it unless the story is just so far gone that, you know, that it's almost incomprehensible. And I think the story is almost incomprehensible. It doesn't make sense. It's not true to the characters. There is really nothing about it that's redeeming. So I'm going to give an F to the story. The cover, I think, is frankly, I think it's terrible. I'm going to give the cover a D minus, and I'm going to give the artwork inside. I agree with you. It absolutely does not fit this series, but I don't think the artwork is blatantly bad. I just don't think it. I think it's the wrong choice for this series. So that's the one area where I'm going to give a little bit of a break, and I'm just going to give a C minus on the artwork because I don't think it's that it's terrible art. I think it's just wrong for this book.
Right.
So overall, you know how I've said sometimes the sum doesn't have to equal the parts. The book is an F. So even though only the story got an F, it was enough to bring the whole thing down to an F.
You know, I agree with you. I honestly do. I really do. So disappointing. Dave, and you love, right?
Yeah, all around.
This was the best book I've read in my entire life. And then I woke up. The cover is a D minus. The interior art is a D minus. The story is an F. And so I join my distinguished colleague from Long Island and cast my vote for an overall F for this travesty you have put upon us. This very dark and cold evening. People can say we love everything now. Thank you so much. And
well, there are those who say, if you dislike it so much, why did you bring it, you know, to the table? And what we try to do, just, you know, I don't mean to put words in Scott's mouth since he brought this one, but what we try to do is to give a sampling of what we're reading or what's coming across our, you know, our in, you know, our interests. And, you know, sometimes it's something where, oh, I really like this, let me bring this to everybody. And sometimes it's just, hey, I read this and, you know, it wasn't good, but it's kind of interesting and maybe it would interest somebody else. And I'm going to bring it to the table and see what everybody thinks.
I'm glad you brought this because I didn't know this existed. I liked the movie and I might have been inspired to waste my time on the first 13 issues. So thank you for saving my valuable time and aggravation.
You're welcome. That's kind of what I was thinking is, you know, with this ultimately, I mean, I picked the book having not read it yet. And of course I didn't expect to hate it. I expected that, you know, I was really hoping I would enjoy it and find that, oh, the series actually got better after I quit. So, I mean, nobody could be more disappointed with this than me, but you know, if any good comes from it, then I hope it's, as you say, Dave, that, you know, there might be somebody else going, oh, gee, I didn't know there was a Fright Night story. Or, you know, they'd seen it around and go, yeah, I was kind of thinking about maybe starting to pick those up. Well, now you know better. So, you know,
if radioactive. You trust our opinion, if you trust our opinions, you know better.
There you go.
All right.
But so that said, I still had fun talking about it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, that's one of the things, too, is, you know, just because we don't like a book, I don't think it makes the show less entertaining. You know, I don't think the show has to mirror the ratings of the books. But, you know, to each their own. Some people like to listen to shows where it's just people saying, hey, this is great, check this out. Right. I think we have a level. It's not that those people aren't honest about it. You know, I think they pick out the things they like a lot or they have a way of seeing positives in everything. But I think we're a little bit more discerning. So
I feel a, you know, this might sound corny, but I really do mean it. I feel a duty to our listeners to be honest, you know, and the honest truth is this book's not worth a dollar, whatever you see it in the back issue bin. It's just not.
Please hold on, hold on to your money.
Yeah, it's not good. Sadly,
hold on to your money. Listen to our podcast. It's free. No. I guess that's it for this week.
All right.
And thanks, guys. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
Welcome to Fright Night. For real.
Where's Amy?
Up here. All you have to do is get by me.
Back, spawn of Satan!
Oh, really? You have to have faith for this to work on me, Mr. Vincent.
Stop! We're gonna make it. Oh,